We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the game to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Rick, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett here, broadcasting live on revolution.radio, the finest in free speech networks. Please do go to revolution.radio and find a way to support true free speech on the internet airwaves. I'm Kevin Barrett of truthjihad.com, where you can subscribe to my Substack and get early access to these shows. Tonight, we're talking about bad science, politicized science. After 9/11, well, it got so bad that Lynn Margulis, the National Medal of Science winner, said that science is dead. In a world where people actually believe that the three World Trade Center towers just committed suicide based on minor office fires kindled by negligible kerosene that had absolutely nothing to do with the situation other than kindling the office fires, and then they just disappeared at free fall acceleration through the path of most resistance, people actually believe that that's possible and think that that happened. Science is dead. Not every scientist, though, is brain dead. And tonight, I'm bringing on a couple of scientists who are totally not brain dead, as well as a politician who isn't brain dead either. In the second hour, Josh Middledorf, one of the liveliest minds in science that I've heard of anyway, comes back on the show to talk about some really wild and crazy issues involving, well, proof that we're not living in a simulation, even though the New York Times quoted a bunch of scientists saying the odds are about 99.9-something percent that we are living in a simulation. Josh can prove that they're wrong. He can also show us that the universe is fine-tuned for life. This is one of the strongest arguments for the existence of God. And he'll question some quantum relationships between the mind and the brain and all sorts of other fun stuff. That's the second hour with Josh Middledorf. All right, and now we're getting going with first the scientist, then the politician. Politician's coming on in 30 minutes. That's Dr. David King. He's running for lieutenant governor here in Wisconsin, and he is a supporter of the health freedom movement. But first, speaking of the health freedom movement, let's get William Willers back on. He's a retired University of Wisconsin biology professor who was a supporter of my struggle for academic freedom and 9/11 truth back in 2006 when I was getting lynched by the mainstream media and not supported by too many colleagues. Well, William Willers was one of the colleagues who did support me. He's an honest man, and he's honest enough to notice there's a problem with the official orthodoxy on face masking. He just wrote a piece called "Who is Ryan Westergaard?" about this public health official, the chief medical officer and state epidemiologist here in Wisconsin.
Hello.
And let him tell you about it. So, hey, welcome, William Willers. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm fine and ready.
Okay. Well, good to have you back on the show. It's been a while. How long has it been since you were on the show anyway?
Oh, I lose track of time. And it was, well, within the last year, I think.
Really? We had you last. Okay. It's, it, maybe it went fast. Anyway, it's good to have you back. And the big issue these past couple of years, of course, has been COVID hysteria. And there's so many aspects of the lies that the mainstream is telling us about COVID, and from it being likely a biological weapon to the fact that so many of these things they've told us to do don't work. And one of those things is face masking. Yet here in Wisconsin, the chief medical officer is insisting that masking works. And a lot of these folks are sad that the masks are starting to come off. And apparently you're not. Okay, so you're a biologist. What's wrong with Westergaard's claim that face masking protects us from COVID?
Well, Kevin, I can't think of anybody who has spent more time looking at mask studies pre-pandemic era. And everyone, and I mean going back decades, has shown that public masking does not stop the spread of viruses. And it's just as simple as that. As a matter of fact, in the month March 2020, when the pandemic was declared, Fauci said there's no reason for anybody to be walking around with a mask. And by May, he was questioned publicly, and because people were wondering about why the mask was important. And what he said was, the mask is something for people to see, and that's it. And so what happened was that on July the 3rd, the state epidemiologist for Wisconsin, Ryan Westergaard, was on television on a state news piece, and you probably know of it, Here and Now with Frederica Freiberg. And he stated, and I've got it written here, this is what he said on the 3rd of July, 2020. The science is in. Because of studies with many people in many countries, we have hard evidence that risk of transmission goes down dramatically when people wear masks. That's end quote. And so, knowing that this was not true, I emailed him at his University of Wisconsin Medical School address from my university address at UW-Oshkosh, and I asked for references. And I did it in a very courteous way. I asked him for references and for all of these studies that were supposed to have happened, and I never got an answer, of course. The man lied. He simply lied. And it was not a minor lie, Kevin, because within a few weeks, as you know, I think it was the next month, the governor of Wisconsin put the whole state under a mask mandate. And so I think when I emailed you earlier, I attached in text at the end of the email this short article that I had done on him. And I'm telling you, it is so frustrating to have this information and know that a principal figure, the state medical officer, has lied and continues to lie and not have an outlet. Nobody wants to touch this.
So where have you submitted the article?
Chance to sound off here.
Mm-hmm. Where have you submitted the article?
I have shown it to a number of people, and they say don't bother.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure.
As a matter of fact, what's really interesting is I have sent it to a number of people. Let's say I live in Door County, and I have shown it to a number of people on school boards because the mask mandate for school children, it's been a big issue. And I sent it to a number of people, and I got a couple of people say, thank you for your comment, and that's all. So I don't know exactly how best to proceed in this. I guess in some way I have given up and gone on to other issues.
Right. Did you? Because I'm pretty sure that the mainstream outlets like, you know, the Capital Times, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and so on wouldn't publish your article. But I wonder if there's a conservative outlet, you know, sort of a local version of Fox News that might. But I can't really think of who that would be.
If you know of any, you send me some suggestions and I'll follow up on them. You know, it's interesting that he was interviewed by Friederike Freiberg, who's I guess a pretty prominent person in Madison, the state capital. And I sent an email to the Here and Now address, which is basically hers. And I said there was a problem with statements that he had made, and I told her exactly what they were. And would she please, as the journalist who interviewed him, would she follow up and clear up any inconsistencies? I tried to be as delicate as possible. Any inconsistencies that might have occurred. I never heard from her, but I think it's quite relevant that she has on multiple occasions thereafter used Westergaard as a source of expert information on that program.
Wow. Yeah. If you look at that statement that he made, it's so extreme. You know, it's not like he's saying, well, there's some evidence that masks might, you know, help lower transmission a little bit, although it's kind of ambiguous, but let's wear the masks because it's probably, you know, might be better than nothing, you know, which would be a lot closer to reality. But no, he's saying lots of studies, large numbers of patients, large numbers of countries, risk of transmission goes down dramatically. That's just BS. There's no, even the studies that purport to show some beneficial effect of masking don't show anything going down dramatically. You have to really, you know, fudge. They're basically BS studies anyway. And even then, they're still finding, you know, very tiny little benefits that turn out to actually be just statistical anomalies. But nobody's found any huge, you know, evidence that risk goes down dramatically. I mean, how could he say something like that?
Well, he made a mistake, and I would assume at this point he was really sorry that he said that and wasn't a little more delicate in the way he did, because he pronounced it as holy writ. And I'll tell you, I think that Westergaard is typical of a raft of medical figures that are being shown as experts all over mainstream media outlets, Leona Wen, Peter Hotez, people like this, and you look at their references, all of them, almost without exception, have after MD in their bios, Masters of Public Health, MPH. And this MPH, this public health discipline has emerged big time within the last couple of decades. I think it wasn't too many years ago, and 2006 sticks in my mind and wouldn't be too far off, the School of Medicine at UW had its name changed to the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And I've been looking at these schools of public health, all of them are campaigning strongly for this pharmaceutical vaccine-oriented path on dealing with COVID, and a shutting down of any of the alternative medicines that could have been beneficial early on. Robert Redfield was up until Rochelle Walensky is the director of the CDC now. And Robert Redfield was up until, I don't know, maybe a year ago. And I saw him in September of 2020 in a Senate hearing. And he's speaking to Jack Reed, the senator from Rhode Island. I can give you links to all of this. This is on C-SPAN. He's talking with the senator, and he holds up the mask. This is the head of the CDC at the time. And he says, Senator, he said, this mask will protect you. He said, I'll go so far as to say that it will protect you better than any vaccine. The vaccine, he said, might be only 70% effective. This mask will protect you.
What Walensky said that?
I find it amazing that people will simply, for the record, in front in situations like that, lie with ease. It simply amazes me.
Yeah, it's, you know, it kind of reminds me of the Ukraine propaganda, you know, and of course, the 9/11 propaganda. In all of these cases, really just outrageous, self-evident falsehoods are put forward brazenly and confidently. And the purpose, of course, is to influence human behavior. I mean, these are people whose idea of communication is not to get across the truth. It's to say something to manipulate the behavior of the person you're talking to. So if you want somebody to wear the mask, you tell them anything even close to the truth, they'll probably say, I think the cost-benefit analysis isn't so great here. But no, if you make up a ridiculous lie, like, oh, this will completely save you, it'll 100% block every viron, blah, blah, or, you know, so this kind of complete idiocy, it works. Just like with Ukraine, you know, if an honest appraisal of what's going on in Ukraine would not sound very good for Ukrainians. You know, they're, you know, a bunch of fanatical nationalists, you know, calling them Nazis is an insult to Hitler.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, and they're not winning, they're losing, and on and on and on. You know, but if you come even within hailing distance of the truth of any of that, then everybody kind of gets discouraged and nobody supports the war in Ukraine and nobody wants the U.S. government to give tens of billions of dollars. So instead, you just lie outrageously. You make up all sorts of non-existent Russian atrocities, or better yet, you find the atrocities that the Ukrainians have committed designed to be blamed on the Russians, and you hype that. And you claim that the Ukrainian grannies are taking out Russian tanks with their knitting needles. You just make up these insane total lies. And people aren't paying much attention, so they actually kind of go, yeah, 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 go Ukraine. They start waving little Ukrainian flags around. So that's the model of communication we've got from these people. They're pure propagandists. They don't care about the truth. They don't care about you understanding anything. All they care about is manipulating your behavior.
That's so sad.
Yeah, and that's not how science works. I mean, science is about getting to the truth. And so when you have these people who are supposed to be representing science putting out this propaganda, it's like Lynn Margulis said, you know, science is dead. It's been dead since 9/11. Oh, man. So, yeah, it must be kind of hard for somebody like you, you know, trained in the sciences to watch this field kind of just melt around you. And nobody in the university seems to be saying much about it. Like, you know, with 9/11, you were one of the very few people that stepped forward in Wisconsin when I was under the gun on that issue. And with COVID, it seems like everybody's afraid to step out of line and get shot down. It's a, you know, what do you know colleagues here in Wisconsin, science people who've been willing to buck the trend on COVID and masking?
I left my campus after 31 years in 1997. I maintain an email address there, and I get news items from what's going on my campus. And all I can say is I love that campus and I'm heartsick at what's going on. It's masking and it's just absolutely following the official narrative. I don't know what to make of students now. I know that since I left all those years ago, that handheld devices seem to have been able to take people's attention. And I have grandchildren. Oh my gosh, they're out of college already. And I think they are so attached to social media and the whole technological world. I'm just wondering if there is a different kind of personality that's been created, because these students seem to have none of the revolutionary and rebellious attitude that I remember from the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s to a degree. And so I don't know what to say. I get these news clips from my campus, and I guess to say I'd have to say I'm sort of sad as to where it's gone. I don't know if anybody I would like to know why the disciplines of sociology and psychology have been so silent on the mask issue. I mean, there's plenty of information out there about the fact, if you really go searching, that no, they don't work. There are meta-analyses that go back and cover the literature of the past and say, no, they don't. And there is now the literature on the harmful effects, health-wise, because people are breathing and rebreathing, and there's a warm, moist situation that favors the buildup of bacteria and the breathing of that and all of that. But I am, because of what I can actually see in young people, I am wondering about what the long-term psychological effects are of being raised in an environment where masking is becoming normalized and what it's doing to really young children. I have a great-granddaughter, and that lives on the East Coast. It's my granddaughter's daughter, who's 2 years old now. And they are very concerned, like a lot of people in the families of people who think like I do, that, and she thinks that I'm way off base. And she sent me a photograph of her two-year-old daughter outdoors with a mask. And that was a real message to me that whatever the mass psychology is that's been perpetrated on the people, it sunk in with her. And others within in my family. And I know that this is true of friends who have extended families, their brothers, sisters, and those their families, who there's been a terrific division psychologically down to the family level of people. And I'm sort of feeling that this is not accidental. I think that there is a project going on that involves this division. And the mask has always been a big thing for me because it is, number one, so visible. It is absolutely visible. And I think that the powers that be, if they can see people accepting the mask, that's an opening to the avenue to vaccination. And don't even get me started on vaccination, because this RNA technology does not conform to the traditional, by a long shot, the traditional definition of a vaccine. This is different. The only similarity is that it comes through a needle, and it's hard to convince people.
Well, wait a minute. These mRNA experimental injections do basically the same thing that vaccinations do, they're supposed to stimulate the immune system in such a way that it reduces the chances of catching and transmitting a disease. So in that sense, you can call them vaccines, but you're right, they're obviously a totally different kind of technology. And more importantly, it looks to me like the evidence shows that their downside greatly outweighs whatever benefits they have, especially for people in the lower age categories. Maybe you could talk a little more about that.
Well, let me just back up here for a minute. A vaccine, up until very recently, has been defined basically as a pathogenic organism that is killed or attenuated. That was the definition. Attenuation doesn't kill it completely, but it makes it ineffective in causing disease. What it is a foreign protein. It's a protein that's foreign to your body. So when these killed or attenuated viruses or bacteria are injected into you, the body recognizes them as foreign protein, and then as a response, your immune system creates antibodies against those foreign proteins. mRNA technology is injection of an RNA, and I don't. Do you know what RNA, ribonucleic acid, is? What it is a code. It is a code for creating protein. Now, the code that is in this mRNA technology is coded to enter your cell and go to the ribosomes where protein is created. And the RNA is coded for a certain kind of protein. And that protein is the spike protein of the, presumably, or that's what we're told, of the COVID-19 causative agent. And so what happens is that your body now starts to produce this spike protein. And the spike protein there circulates in your body. And this is what we're told. And your body will then build up antibodies against that spike protein. So it's different in that respect. What you're doing, what we're told, is that the antibody is being built up against the spike protein, not against the causative agent itself, a virus. It's just a part of this virus. And I've been too far away from immunology for me. The years are too many for me to start talking about the reactions against the spike protein. But there is an awful lot of clotting that's going on, I'll just let it go at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people who listen to the show regularly have heard all kinds of folks. Recently, Drs. Peter McCullough and Jessica Rose, as well as Merrill Nass and Steve Kirsch, and on and on and on. We've had a whole lot of the folks out there who've been leading the charge in questioning the vaccines and looking at some of the data showing that people have apparently been killed in fairly large numbers. So they've had pretty strong arguments for estimates that six figures worth of Americans have been killed by these vaccines, and it seems to be disproportionately affecting the young and working age people, which is really kind of sad. COVID itself seems to disproportionately affect the old and infirm, so I'm not sure how much of an improvement that is. If you maybe reduce the rate of COVID deaths a little bit, but meanwhile you're creating deaths in people who are losing a lot more years of life expectancy. So yeah, I agree with you there. Well, you know, we're going to have
Kevin. I'm 84. I got COVID last summer in August, and I knew what was coming, so I had all the vitamin D, the vitamin C, the zinc, and all of that, and I was able to get ivermectin. And I'm fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I caught it last summer too, and got through it okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I know it was COVID, or what they call COVID, because I lost my sense of smell, and that was August, and it hasn't come back yet. So,
wow.
But that's a different issue.
The lethality of this virus is fairly low, even for the older people, and the polls show that Americans have massively overestimated its lethality. When they asked people to guess, you know, they were guessing things like 5, 10, 20, 30, 50% mortality rate, when the reality is probably more like, you know, 0.5%. So, hey, you know, solution to these problems probably is in the political arena. And we now are making contact with another guest from Wisconsin, Dr. David King. He's a candidate for lieutenant governor, and he's been attracting support from the COVID freedom or health freedom movement. And I wonder what he thinks about Dr. Westergaard telling us that masks totally shut down COVID. So, hey, I think we have him on the line now. Dr. David King, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Hey, welcome. So good to have you. I've just been speaking with Professor William Willers. He's a retired University of Wisconsin Oshkosh biology professor who's been waging a kind of a lonely struggle to knock some sense into people around the fact that masking just doesn't work for respiratory viruses, and that the vaccines are vastly less safe and effective than has been claimed. And I'm just wondering about your thoughts on those issues.
Well, first, let me deal with the mask mandate. And my problem with that is we all, if we slow down and not be afraid and just think, we'll realize the mask doesn't work. And the only thing the mask doing is harming you as an individual because you're not getting no fresh air in. So, you know, and now you hear them say that the cloth mask, they're saying the cloth mask don't work. You need the N95. And I'm wondering why they said we need an N95. Is it because they done made too many and they need to sell their stock? So they leaked out that the cloth don't work by the N95?
Yeah, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? They keep changing their stories. You know, first it was everybody knew that masks don't work. No masks work against respiratory viruses. And then suddenly, as COVID came along, Fauci first restated that. And then somehow the established wisdom turned on its head, even though there was no more science to support it. And everybody said the cloth masks are great. Isn't this wonderful that people are tying bandanas around their faces? And now suddenly they're admitting that the cloth masks don't work, but maybe the N95s do. Well, the N95s theoretically would have a better chance of doing something, wouldn't they?
N95 are like cloth masks insofar as stopping the passage of, that the data show that they also will not impact the rate of spread of the virus. N95s were designed for people in hospital situations for temporary use only. When they're close to people who could be coughing and sneezing, and so particulate globular material is being created. It has to be very close fitting, and it is not to be used for extended periods. And so this business about, well, cloth masks, yeah, we yield. They don't work, but go get N95s. It's baloney.
Okay. Well, so the mandates kept people masked up and conforming and created so many arguments and fights on planes and in restaurants and bars and things like that. And now we're kind of reaching the point where the establishment is starting to admit that the whole thing is over. Now we're all supposed to be crazy and hysterical about Russia instead of about COVID. But there still are some mask mandates in individual businesses. What's the situation right now in Wisconsin, I wonder? And I think the state mask mandate has expired. So, Dr. King, do you know what the current situation is? Are there still mandates in counties or what?
Right now is by choice now. Even at the airport, it's by choice. When you ride in the lift now, it's optional. It's choice. I think that the thing about it is, I think they're trying to wing everybody now off the masses because they realize how much damage and fear that they put on people, that people will even wear a mask in their own house around their own family, you know, because of the fear. And if they would just slow down and just do some homework, you'll be like, oh, wait a minute. This is not as bad as they said it was. Yes, people are getting sick, but wait a minute. And they're saying, oh, they're getting sick, and they're like, okay, so let's look for a second. And when you look at it, and we done found numerous of family members that their family went to the doctor for COVID, and then they had this COVID protocol where they was giving them this one medication, and it was affecting their kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, remdesivir was killing people.
Remdesivir.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I think with the height of it, because, you know, we all deal with fear differently. some of us, we deal with fear as, okay, let's see where this come from and how we deal with it. And then others deal with fear like a deer in the headlights. They just freeze, and whatever somebody say, that's it.
Yeah, and some people just seem to obey, you know, whatever they're being told. There's a whole theory of fear-based brainwashing or trauma-based mind control, they call it, where they traumatize people, and then we're in that state of fear with a deer in the headlights. Look, the controller comes along and tells them what to think. And, you know, we saw that after 9/11. We saw it with COVID. And I think to some extent we're seeing it with the Ukraine thing today as, you know, the nuclear war fears are being revived. You know, I'm old enough to remember just when that duck and cover stuff was ending in the early 60s. Bill, do you remember the duck and cover drills where they had kids diving under the desks
Yes.
to simulate nuclear death?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was in my mid-teens, I was raised in the Army. And my father was stationed in Washington, D.C., so we lived in Arlington. And yes, duck and cover, I remember very well.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to bring those back anytime soon. Well, Dr. King, you're running for lieutenant governor, and it sounds like, you know, some of the people here who would be supporting Ron Johnson, who's been a leading voice of the health freedom movement, might be interested in supporting you. So is this like your leading issue, or maybe you tell us a little bit more about why you're running and, you know, what positions
Hello?
On the issues you have? Dr. King? I wonder if we – did we lose Dr. David King?
I heard a noise that sounded
Yeah.
like a sign-off.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Kevin, what's, you live in a smaller town than I do. As a matter of fact, I live in the outskirts of a town of less than 10,000. But you're in Lone Rock or
– Yeah, I'm actually out – I'm outside of Lone Rock, somewhere sort of over towards Spring Green, out in the country. So, yeah, the nearest village.
I just wondered what your medical situation is, and whatever the medical people around there, what their position is.
You know, it's hard to tell because if they think like we do, they're afraid to say so openly. So who knows? But you know, when you go down to the clinic, they make you mask up. And it's, you know, I've been pretty successful at going places without a mask, even throughout the mandate, you know, like Walmart and things like that. Although I don't go to Walmart very often. I didn't really go a lot of places very often because it was just too depressing to go out and see all those masked faces and then have them
Yeah.
harass you when you don't put the mask on. So I got a lot of gardening done, got a lot of kayaking done, got a lot of bicycling done, got a lot of truth jihadi work done.
It's interesting when you look around, they keep changing. They keep changing, and you think it's over, and then all of a sudden, this other facet of society, they're masking up. And this school district requires masks, and this other one doesn't. And now they say, okay, fine. No, we know the cloth masks don't work, but they'll get N95. And this information for 2 years, 2 years more, shifting, constant, conflicting information, and it sort of keeps people off balance. The whole society's off balance. There's nothing that's stable.
Yeah, that's true.
And you,
yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, and, you know, I got around it, too, because what I did, when they would ask me, I remember I was at my son's basketball game, and I told them my son would not wear a mask. And the guy said, okay, no problem, but we need you to wear a mask. And I said, I can't wear a mask. And the guy said, why you cannot wear a mask? And I said, medical reasons. So he walks away, and then he comes back to me, and he says, okay, I don't mean to be in your business, but everybody got masks on, and you don't have one. Do you mind telling me your medical reason? I said, Hibber law, and he walked away and never came back. And a lady asked me, she said, I heard what you said to him. Do you mind? I'm just nosy, but do you mind if you could tell me your medical reason? I said, yeah, sick of masks.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, our producer, Mr. Rowe here, is an expert kind of in this. He did a whole article on how you can ride Amtrak without masks. And basically, that's true. If you stick to your guns, you say, I can't wear a mask, and they try to, you know, inquire into the reasons, you can always say, you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act does say that you're not allowed to ask that. So, you know, you don't have to tell them why you can't wear a mask. And yeah, I think I can say I'm allergic to masks too. And I've gotten away with that a few times myself. So, yeah. Yeah. But you know, it's tough though in the medical places. They really, I guess, brainwash the people there. And anybody who doesn't agree is afraid to speak up. And that's kind of the most discouraging thing, but there still is this vibrant health freedom movement. And I'm wondering, David, have you kind of interfaced with that? Like, I've seen a couple of pictures at your website at what looks like maybe a rally with some people with signs that look like they're part of the health freedom movement. So have you been a part of that?
Yes, I've been a part of a lot of the medical freedom rallies. And it was about the no mandates on people that worked in the hospitals, that they should have a choice. I mean, because you got to remember, all 2020, they was the heroes. But then the moment the vaccine came out, they wanted to force them to take the shot. And if they didn't, they lost their job. So here you go from being a hero to a zero. So I didn't think that was fair, so I joined in the fight for medical freedom. I joined in the fight to take the mask off our children. I'm also in the fight for CRT. So I've been in a lot of the fights and the rallies because I believe that we're still in the most freest country in the world, that we should have the freedom to make a decision for ourselves. And if they would stop playing with us and give everybody all the information, then each family has the right to make a decision for themselves and not government or anybody else bullying them to throw a mask on or whatever if you give both sides. And you know, you got two sides of this thing. Give both sides out and let everybody make their own decision.
You're here. Well, do you think that social media is going to open up now a little bit with Elon Musk buying out Twitter and saying that he wants to restore free speech there? You know, we've just been through this period when the internet has gone from being a relatively free kind of playground for ideas where anybody could say anything. And then the past 5 years or so, it just got locked down completely. And then COVID pretty much finished it off. And, you know, I can't post YouTubes anymore of most of what I do. Like this show right now, if I try to put this on YouTube, boom, that's it. You know, a strike. Pretty soon my 15 years of work are gone. So the internet has just become a totally locked down, and that's something that needs to change.
Yeah, Kevin, have you tried BitChute?
Yeah, I'm doing False Flag Weekly News now on Rumble instead of YouTube because I kept getting up to two strikes and being right on the edge of losing, you know, 15 years of, you know, 10,000 hours of work. So I just moved to Rumble, and anything that has remotely to do with anything where they're going to start, you know, harassing me or deplatforming me, I just put that over on Rumble, which I highly recommend. It's weird though how this situation now is created a kind of a polarization, where people who think one way go to Rumble, you know, people who think the other way go to the, you know, YouTube and the social media, Facebook, whatever. That doesn't seem like it's healthy for society. And I'm wondering, Dr. King, you're in politics. Do you have any ideas about how we could fix this situation where the censorship is driving polarization?
Well, I think that, I mean, for me, you know, I am I'm a two-time felon on YouTube. I'm about 4 or 5 times felon on Facebook. So, you know, and that's just because I tell the truth. And so, you know, until we get some kind of control in there, or if the federal government make that's going to be hard right now, but if they would make laws and legislation that will allow our free speech to be on anything. But, you know, and if you and I go away from the YouTubes and go away from Facebook, then we're taking the truth with us. So we have to stay on these. You know, I know we got to change the words sometimes, like I did my show last night, and we've got to talk about the vaccine. I was like, oh, we can't use that word. Let's use the word cookie. So we changed the word so that way we didn't get punished for telling the truth. So we just got to look at different ways. It's just like with Jesus with the Bible. The disciples kept asking him, why are you using parables? So we have to use parables so we don't get censored.
Hear, hear. Well, you're a Christian. I'm Muslim, actually. We're hitting the end of Ramadan here. And one thing we probably would agree on is that religion has a really important place in society, in families. And there seems to be a war on traditional religious values going on in a lot of different ways. And then there's some pushback against that, of course. We've seen that with, you know, the people who don't think that the preschoolers should be made to worship sexual deviants and things like that. And others say, yeah, they should have to wait until, like, I guess in Florida, you have to be in third grade now to get that kind of programming. But there does seem to be a real clash, speaking of polarization, between those of us who are still part of the traditional religions and the kind of the same folks who are censoring everybody on social media and pushing the vaccines and the face masks, who is almost like that's a substitute religion, you know, and they can't stand traditional religion. So, you know, it's you're a Christian running for office. Are you kind of, you know, working with local religious communities?
Yes. And see, my doctorate is in theology. And so I'm also a pastor for over 24 years. And you're absolutely right. The problem is it doesn't matter what religion it really is. It's more of the principles of God, or the principles of Allah, where that's what they're trying to destroy, those principles. Love your family, right? Be a good citizen. Love your neighbor. Don't bear false witness. So all the principles that we live by, that we stand, is what they're attacking. They're attacking our principles. They're attacking our moral compass. They're attacking what we consider a traditional family. So those are the issues that they're attacking. And when you look at it for what it really is, they're also trying to destroy the moral compass. So, so it doesn't matter. And one thing that I loved about the Founding Fathers here, if they allowed this country to be free, that you have free of religion, not from religion, but of religion, that you have the right to worship whatever you want to worship. But what that does is each worship brings a different type of principles. But when you look at them all, they all are in line, even though we go down a different street. Those principles is what's important. And so when you bring principles back in politics, and with me, I'm bringing God back in government, we bring the principles of God, and then we be that light to show people how to love one another, how to use godly wisdom to solve problems that is out here, because man wisdom got us in this mess. So we need the wisdom of God to get us out of it.
Amen, brother. Well, Bill, what do you think about the idea that the COVID hysteria with the kind of worshiping of masks and the lockdowns and the whole nine yards, the vaccines, is kind of a substitute religion, that the fanaticism and the fundamentalist kind of approach to all of that is it almost looks like kind of the negative side of religion moved over into COVID worship.
I have been involved in a 30-year conversation about science as a religion. Science is a religion. And I think that if you start looking at, well, what exactly is religion? It's what basically you consider to be of utmost importance in reality. You could go in that direction. And I think in traditional religions, at least the Judeo-Christian lineage, that that would be God. And that has been, it has been changed. It is science now. And it is, well, follow the science. The whole question now of these spokespeople that you see on television who represent science, I forget his name. You know who he is. He's a great big guy who is head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. And you see him all the time on the talk shows. And he's saying the big question now is society going to follow the science? And when you look at the science, it is the kind of science that comes right out of the pharmaceutical industry. It is absolutely a narrow, narrow path. And the fact of the matter is there are many, many scientists who are very much in disagreement with this whole mRNA technology. And I think as soon as the pandemic showed itself, and there was an ironclad rule. There is only one narrative, and you follow that narrative, and any deviance, it could be organizations of thousands of medical scientists, doctors, and so forth, if it deviates from that narrow narrative, it is automatically called misinformation. And nobody, they say, well, that's misinformation. You hear it on CNN, MSNBC, PBS, even NewsHour, and all of that. They never define specifically what was stated, what was said that was misinformation. If it doesn't hew, it's called misinformation. And that should have been a warning sign to everybody in the sciences, because science requires open discussion about everything. And so the fact that there is only one right answer and you're wrong if you don't agree with that one answer should have been a warning sign from day one.
Yeah, you're basically deemed a heretic and burned at the digital stake. It's crazy how that's all happened.
Look at the Merrill Nass. Merrill Nass was a notable person in many respects. As a practicing physician and also as a researcher. And this state medical board pilloried her. And I mean, the people on that medical board were hardly had the right to shine her shoes. And so these medical boards are keeping dissident medical voices at bay. I mean, even people who early on were using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin as treatments were threatened with loss of their position, loss of the right to practice medicine. And that was absolutely unprecedented, something like that. The use of off-label medicines like that is perfectly appropriate. And ivermectin is safe as aspirin. It's on the World Health Organization list of essential medicines. And that means it should be easily available everywhere. And after this past the summer of this past summer, ivermectin became unavailable. None of the articles were. Is everybody okay there? There's an awful
lot
of
There's been a lot of noise going on. Somebody, David, are you bumping your phone?
No, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I don't know either. I wonder if somebody's messing with us.
I'm alone in my bedroom, and so yeah, not coming through.
That's strange. Okay, well,
I'm just sitting in my garage, so.
Yeah, and I'm sitting in front of my laptop with no background noise. So, yeah, it's as if somebody were injecting some background noise here. Well, we pretty much gotten to the end of the hour anyway, and it's been a wonderful discussion with both science, spirituality, religion, politics, everything that your mother told you to never talk about at the dinner table. We talk about here on Truth Jihad Radio. So before we go, Dr. David King, send us to your website. I bet some people might want to help out.
Okay, the website is king4forwi.com. king4forwi.com. Phone number is 414-676-0842. 414-676-0842.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I probably will be voting for you for lieutenant governor, and I'll probably even be voting for Ron Johnson at some point, which I never thought I would do, you know, when he first ran.
I know,
ran.
Isn't it strange?
Yeah. Bill, you and I, we were all sort of more sort of leaning towards the left and thinking that the Republicans were even worse than the Democrats, but now it's looking the other way around. What happened?
Something I don't know. I've been reading some things recently about, you've probably heard the term mass formation.
I'm going to have Matthias Desmond on the show, hopefully, to talk about that.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's apparently there has been what amounts to a mass hypnosis.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to flip the Democrats. Yeah. It's hitting the Democrats worse than the Republicans.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing to sit down with people you've known all your life, family members, and you give them some facts. I mean, absolutely, it is a fact that you tell them that, and it's uncomfortable. And you see, you look at their eyes, and you see their mind snap shut.
Okay, well, nobody's, our audience here at Troops Jihad Radio is not snapping shut in their minds. They're definitely an open-minded, lively bunch, and that's why we bring on great guests like we had tonight. Well, thank you so much, William Willers and Dr. David King. It was a great conversation. Look forward to more down the line.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. God
you
bless.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Okay. Take care, Bill. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, back in the next hour with more talk about science with Josh Middledorf, one of my favorite scientists. We talk about all kinds of wild and crazy cosmic stuff. That's the stuff you hear about here on Troops Jihad Radio.
TroopsJihadRadio.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
In the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the live broadcast of Truth Jihad Radio, your source of heretical insights, bricks heaved through the Overton window, and other troublesome information that certain folks, especially those brainwashed by the mainstream, may have a hard time handling. But you can handle it, can't you? Because you're a Truth Jihad Radio listener. Hey, I have faith. All right, well, we're going to get back to the issue of science, not so much the failings of science, but some of the far-out fringes of science or the places where science may have something to say, or maybe not, about the big cosmic questions. One of my favorite scientists is Josh Middledorf. He's an anti-aging scientist. And no, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was getting old a few years ago, but now he's middle-aged and heading for youth. And pretty soon he'll undergo anti-puberty and go from being a teenager to a child. And then he'll be a baby and leap back into a womb and turn into a gamete and a zygote and an egg and sperm and then be reabsorbed into his parents' bodies. No, that will not happen. At least we don't think it will, unless, of course, Earth crashes into a cryosynclastic infundibulum, in which case all bets are off. In any case, no, he's an anti-aging scientist, meaning that he studies anti-aging supplements and practices and things like that. And so he is remarkably youthful for his age. And he's also got all kinds of other interesting ideas. He just published a piece of his Substack called Proof We Are Not Living in a Simulation. And that was a great relief to me because I had read a New York Times story several years ago saying that these scientists thought it was like 99.9% plus probable that we were living in a simulation. And they laid out their reasoning, and it was quite insane. so anyway, let's try to figure out whether we're in the Matrix or not. We're definitely in the Matrix politically, but maybe not existentially. So, hey, Josh, hi. How are you on the line?
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, good to have you back.
You make me think of Wonkavite and Vita Wonk. Do you remember a book by
You're not talking about the Willy Wonka books.
Willy Wonka and the
Roald Dahl, right? Yeah.
Roald Dahl after the Chocolate Factory. There was a sequel. in which his grandmother wants to get young, and they give her too much Wonkavite, and she ends up back in the womb, and they have to reverse that with Vita-Wonk.
Oh, there you go. I was thinking more in terms of Philip K. Dick's Counter Clock World, which is one of his minor works, but even his minor works are pretty more fun than most people's major ones. Okay, well, hopefully you are at least to some extent an anti-aging scientist in that sense as well, even if you're not headed back for the womb. But, you know, we were thinking about talking about the anti-aging stuff, and then we realized we've already talked about that in a previous show. So instead, we're going to debunk the people who think that we're living in a simulation. And I thought your article on that was really interesting and wonderful, and none of that was in the stuff I've read by the people who think that maybe we are in a simulation. So how come they haven't noticed the stuff that you noticed?
That's a hell of a place to start.
maybe we should start at the beginning. So start where you want.
How come they haven't noticed? First of all, if you're a computer scientist, the idea of simulating, it's what we do. I do a lot of simulations. It's the most fun thing you can do with a computer, far more fun than email or Facebook, is simulating systems and run them and see what happens and see if it looks like reality. I do that for biological systems, for ecological systems, for traffic and economic systems and physical systems. I've done a lot of simulations. It's a great deal of fun. And I imagine anybody who's caught up in that, which is a lot of programmers today, have got to think, well, this is really deep. Why wouldn't any future civilization want to do a whole lot more of this kind of fun stuff? But where I can't imagine their mentality, and I think you join me with this, what is it like to think there's no difference between my sense of my consciousness and what a computer would feel if I programmed it to have the same reflexes that I had and the same sensations and or the same nerve impulses and interactions. It seems to me that my existence as a real being is something I don't doubt. I never have doubted. I can't doubt it. And the idea that I'm just a bunch of switches flipping up and down in a computer is a non-starter with me. What do you think about that? And what do you think about the mentality of somebody who could think, yeah, maybe I'm just a bunch of switches flipping on and off?
Yeah, I think those people must, you know, have a screw loose upstairs or something. But I guess some of them are very bright people. You know, these transhumanists are actually dedicated to trying to achieve immortality by downloading themselves into a computer and living forever as software. And,
yes.
You know, I enjoyed that when I read it as science fiction by Rudy Rucker. You know, he's a mathematician in East Bay. I don't know if he's still around, but his science fiction novels are kind of fun and pretty goofy. But he kind of took that approach that we imagine a future full of robots that are just as human as humans, and then they start crusading for robots' rights and things like that. Demanding equal treatment, they identify as robots, and so you can't discriminate against them and this sort of thing. It's fun stuff in science fiction, but in reality, these people who are, you know, welcoming a massive transformation of the planet, such that essentially humanity and maybe all biological systems are destroyed, and yet it's better because everything will live on forever in a computer simulation. That strikes me as there's something just I don't even have to.
Chilling.
Yeah. You don't need to go into heavy duty intellectual calisthenics to figure out that there's something wrong with that.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I'm embarrassed that there's overlap between my community, which does the biology of life extension, and the transhuman community, which looks to adapt humans in other ways, connecting our brains to computers and merging the biological system with mechanical systems. And that just gives me the creeps.
Yeah, it's another example of kind of bad false religion. You know, I was talking in the first hour with, let's see, with William Willers and David King about how a lot of the crazy reaction to the COVID scamdemic involved what seemed like almost a kind of a hysterical religious response, like almost parodying the worst side of conventional religion with extreme fundamentalism, intolerance, deeming people heretics, and, you know, running around flashing symbols, sacred symbols like the sacred mask or the sacred vaccine. And if you blaspheme against them, you get kicked off of social media and digitally burned at the stake. Well, likewise, it seems to me that these people pushing transhumanism are really messianic, millenarian madmen and madwomen, and whatever their pronouns may be, these insane people, they're missing religion. You know, we're made to worship. We're made to have ritual practices and accept sacred symbols that can give us like a ladder step upwards towards getting closer to God or into a higher state of consciousness, whatever you want to call it. That's our nature. And when we live in a culture that denies that, it's the return of the repressed. It's going to come back somewhere. And so it comes back with, you know, COVID worship. It comes back with transhumanism. You know, it's very much like, you know, the yearning for eternal life, and then the religious teachings about how, you know, you can achieve nirvana in Buddhism, or you'll go to paradise or hellfire in the monotheistic religions. We're all at some level wrestling with death and transcendence. And traditional religion has a very well worked out, sophisticated kind of symbol system and system of ritual practices designed to work with that. But when that's taken away, as it has been, then people go crazy and they start worshiping COVID and they start turning into transhumanists and imagining they're going to live forever, not in heaven or hell or nirvana, but in some kind of computer simulation. So anyway, that's my sense, is that.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. One is that, yeah, maybe there's this innate tendency, but there's also really sophisticated manipulation of mass psychology going on, and exploiting whatever human weaknesses there are and whatever social weaknesses we have to put a fraud over on the public and get people to defraud each other. You don't have to listen to the radio anymore. In my community, you just have to walk out on the street. And not so much this year, but last year, I used to walk out on the streets of my neighborhood that used to be friendly, and people would cross the street to avoid passing me on the sidewalk.
Was that because you weren't wearing a mask? They knew you were a heretic, or was it the not wearing a mask, or what was the problem?
Well, of course, I wasn't wearing a mask, but I think they do that for everybody. You know, just staying away from other humans was part of the fear that's been inculcated in people. So the second response to the ideas you're putting out is religion. Science has become a religion, and that's something I wrote about just the other day. They call it scientism. And it's a belief. Well, first of all, I'm a scientist. I think like a scientist. I evaluate evidence like a scientist. I'm an advocate for science. But that's different from taking science as a worldview and saying it's the only way to know reality, and that there are two parts of scientism. One is to deny all the intuitive and emotional and spiritual ways that we have to perceive reality that are different from the scientific method and also valid. But also, the science that's frozen into scientism is 19th century science, pre-quantum, in which the world is a solid thing, particles floating in a fixed space. And that's the kind of science that leads to the idea, well, there can't be anything else besides particles floating in space, because that's a closed causal system. We've accounted for all the forces there are among particles, and therefore consciousness must not be a thing. consciousness must be some kind of illusion. And that is another answer to your first question about how people can come to believe that consciousness is generated by computation. It comes from this scientism, this branch of scientism, which says, as the 19th century scientists thought, that there is only matter in the world, that matter, the forces among particles are really, really account for everything in the world. And I believe that's provably false. It's one of the things that I wrote to you about in this preparation for tonight's meeting. So from there, I mean, why don't I open it up to that whole long preface that I sent to you, and which of those topics do you think would be interesting to discuss next?
Well, actually, before we leave the issue of not living in a simulation, maybe you could sort of just briefly address the issue that you raised around the kind of computing power that would be necessary to generate the particles, right, or the simulations of the particles. That is, you know, the people who argue for the simulation are basically using that kind of argument, you know, claiming there would be enough computer power to totally simulate everything in the entire universe, you know, that, and that would happen in, you know, who knows, million years in the future. You know, our descendants or the descendants of other intelligent beings in the universe would want to run ancestor simulations. And so they would run these really vast simulations on these unimaginably powerful computers that would be powered by wrapping a kind of a bubble around stars or the sun here and absorbing all the energy that all the stars put out and putting all that energy to work to run better and better simulations. Kind of a weird assumption about what highly intelligent evolved beings would be doing. Anyway, so that the argument goes that there's plenty of energy to build big enough computers to easily run simulations that can adequately simulate everything in the entire universe. And since that's the case, and we assume that's what our descendants will be doing, therefore almost all possible existing worlds would actually be simulations. And so therefore we must be in a simulation. So they're using that kind of probabilistic quantitative argument to claim that we're probably in a simulation. And then so you actually respond with a similar, or an argument that's similarly based on the amount of computer power that there would be to simulate the entire known universe. And you come up with a very different answer from them. So you should at least briefly summarize that before you go on.
Well, yes. The essence of that argument is that if you're simulating two things, think classically, if you have two particles or two planets or two atoms, it takes twice as much computing power as simulating one. And if you have three, it takes three times as much. And if you have 1,000, it takes 1,000 computing power. And, you know, you scale that up to millions and billions and however many we have in our body, you get a really large number, but maybe one that you could imagine some huge supercomputer of the future tackling. And my argument is that this leaves out quantum mechanics. Things work out very differently in quantum mechanics. Some of your more sophisticated listeners probably realize that the basic unit, the thing that we talk about in quantum mechanics, is a wave function, which is a function on space. If it's large here, it means that the electron has a large probability of existing here, and if it's very small and in a different place, it means you'll never find the electron or very rarely find the electron there. It's a probability function, and that's a good understanding for one electron. And a lot of people imagine, including physicists who should know better, well, then two electrons, you just have two functions in the same space, and so it takes twice as much computing power. Three, you have three times the computing power because you have three of these these wave functions. And that's not the way quantum mechanics works. There's entanglement in quantum mechanics. You've probably heard of that word, and your listeners have heard of the word, but in this case, it means something in particular. You can't talk about the probability of electron 1 independent of electron 2, and you can't talk about the probability of electron 2 independent of electron 1. Instead, you have to talk about the probability that, well, if electron 1 is here, then there's a certain probability of electron 2 is there. If electron 1 is in a different place, then there's a different probability for electron 2. So you end up with a probability for a configuration, a probability that the system is set up in a certain way. And the computing power now increases much, much faster than it takes twice as much. You imagine plotting the wave function for one electron in a three-dimensional space, but the configuration of all the possible positions of electron 1 and all the positions of electron 2 is in a six-dimensional space. A six-dimensional space, a billion times more pixels than a three-dimensional space. Imagine that you need 1,000 pixels arrayed along the axis to get good resolution, 1,000 pixels along the x-axis, 1,000 along the y-axis, and 1,000 along the z-axis. That means it takes a billion pixels for the first simulation. And people who are not thinking clearly think, well, so it takes 2 billion for the simulation of two electrons. It's not the way quantum mechanics works. In quantum mechanics, the wave function itself is no longer a function on a three-dimensional space. It's a function on a six-dimensional space. So you need 1,000 pixels times 1,000 pixels times 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000. So that's a billion billion pixels to just do two particles. And of course, it's a billion 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 to do four particles. And we haven't even gotten close to a water molecule. A single water molecule is 13 particles. The computing power needed to simulate a quantum system goes up exponentially. It just rises really, really fast as you try to simulate larger and larger systems. And to the extent that life is dependent on these quantum effects, I believe it is, that life is opportunistic enough that it takes advantage of quantum effects. There's a whole science, it's a new science of quantum biology that looks for these things. It's another exciting field we could talk about another time. But yes, quantum mechanics is essential to life. And I don't think you can simulate a human mind or a human body without taking these quantum effects into account. And to that extent, it becomes enormously more computation intensive. Enormously meaning instead of taking twice as long when you add two particles instead of one, it takes a billion times as long. So that's essentially the argument, that the amount of computing power that it takes to compute a quantum system the size of the universe is really a classical computer that's much, much, much bigger than our universe. Obviously impractical. And then you go to, well, what about quantum computers? Yeah, you can simulate the universe with a quantum computer. Maybe that's the way to think about what our universe is. Maybe it's a quantum computer simulating itself. To simulate our universe with a quantum computer takes a quantum computer the size of our universe.
Sounds like an infinite regression.
Yeah.
Because you need another one to simulate that. Well, I suppose some of the people who would try to argue against you might say, you know, we wouldn't need to perfectly simulate every last quanta, but rather, you know, we could stick with the classical effects of the quanta, just like in the, you know, in the classical world, all of these quanta resolve into these kinds of predictable things that Newtonian physics can describe. So we could just do our simulation at the Newtonian level. However, as you say, Josh, that would suggest that what you would end up with in these simulations wouldn't be remotely as rich as the real thing. It would be sort of like saying, you know, we just ran a perfect simulation of World War II that's exactly the same as World War II. You know, well, what is that? Well, it's this movie. You know, it's a war movie. No, it's that war movie is just a piece of celluloid. You know, no, it's a perfect simulation. Well, no, it's not. It's not the real war. And you know, likewise, the simulation that didn't account for the quantum aspect of things would not be remotely as rich. And as you say, there are biological consequences apparently to quantum effects that wouldn't be covered. So anybody who thinks that they're going to be in a simulation that's just as real as the real world is probably barking up the wrong tree, even you know, for those reasons, as well as the ones we talked about earlier. So, okay.
It depends on that life uses quantum mechanics in ways that are different from just chemistry. Quantum mechanics is used as a basis for understanding the properties of chemical elements, but that's a very approximate use of quantum mechanics. You can't calculate the properties of an atom bigger than hydrogen with a computer simulation with an accurate simulation. You can only use various one particle at a time approximation, essentially using the approximation that each electron is independent of all the other electrons, and you just have one wave function for each particle. I think that may be where part of the illusion comes from. In chemistry, they do that a lot. They say, well, this electron is in this wave function, and the next one is in another wave function, as each electron had its own wave function. And they do that and forget that that's an approximation to the real thing, and it doesn't produce exact answers. And in fact, it needs to be adjusted to make it agree with the real world. I mean, we're talking about big offsets. Sometimes it's accurate to 10 or 20%. Sometimes it's 40 or 50% off. And they just adjust the models to agree with the real world. So yes, it's common practice to simulate quantum mechanics of 10 systems with 10 independent wave functions for the 10 electrons. And yet, people who understand know that that's a necessary approximation. It's just because we can't compute the real thing. It takes too much computational power. So they make the approximation that all these electrons are independent. And perhaps they forget. A lot of people do forget that this is only an approximation. And if you're trying to simulate the real world or any biological system, and which I believe is subtle in the way that quantum mechanics comes into play in the human brain, you can't leave out those effects.
Okay. And then one subject that sometimes comes up in this kind of discussion is Moore's law holds that there's this constant exponential increase in computing power going on based on improving the chip technology. And I think I read somewhere that in the last couple of years or something like that, Moore's law has stopped holding. So maybe you could just mention that, the question of whether computing power can keep exponentially increasing forever or not, because that would be relevant to what kind of simulation you'd be able to run in the future.
The way that computing power has gone on increasing by making chips smaller and smaller, each element on the chip smaller and smaller. And yes, the process levels off because as you get too small, you get quantum fluctuations. If you have 1,000 atoms in each transistor, there's a chance there's going to be a fluke in one of those that your computer viable. So maybe 10,000 atoms per transistor comes to be a stopping point where you need a whole new idea for Moore's Law. If you want to make faster and smaller computer chips, you can't do it the traditional way. You're going to need a whole new platform for computing to do that. So, yes, there is a natural place where Moore's Law has to level off, because we get to the point where clearly you can't make a transistor smaller than an atom. And in practice, you can't make it smaller than a few thousand atoms.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Moore's Law leveling off is a good thing, because then I won't feel like I need to buy a new MacBook Pro, you know, every 5 years. I'll be able to wait 8 years. So moving on to another interesting related subject, I think, is the fine-tuning argument. I discussed this. I'm trying to remember if I discussed this on the air with Dr. David Ray Griffin. I think I did. He published a book of arguments for God, but not God, G-A-W-D. He says kind of the classical theistic position is arguing for God, G-A-W-D, who's omnipotent and so on and so forth, omniscient, omnipotent, and so on. And he argues in favor of God, G-O-D, who is, well, the process theologians would say that, you know, this God is kind of making everything the best that it can be, but working with materials that have built-in limitations. That's kind of a quick and dirty way to describe it. Anyway, so the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God or God or whatever you want to call it is that, as you write in this piece that I've taken the liberty of publishing on the radio blog, the universe seems fine-tuned for life, that the fundamental constants in physics seem to have been set exactly right to an extreme degree of precision to create a very, very rich universe that can, for instance, support life as we know it, and that the odds of that happening by chance, of course, would seem incredibly remote. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your approach to this fine-tuning of the universe to create a beautiful, rich, incredibly complex, and life-supporting universe.
Well, first I want to refer people to Stephen Barr, who is an emeritus professor, I believe, at University of Maryland in theoretical physics. And he is both a very knowledgeable, competent physicist and a practicing Catholic. And he's made this argument, I think, more strongly than I would make it, that the what we call anthropic coincidences imply God. So going back to the science now. So Stephen Barr is the name, B-A-R-R. Going back to the science, I think that the paradigm before 1970 or so was that physics has these arbitrary numbers in it. The physical laws happen to be the way they are. Every physics equation has constants in it that physics doesn't even try to explain. For example, E equals mc squared. Well, E can be anything. It can be an energy that you measure and you turn it into a certain mass, so that tells you what m is. And so E and m are measured properties of the universe, but c squared is a constant, and that's the velocity of light. And if you ask a physicist, he would say, well, we don't even try to explain that. The physics, this velocity of light just is what it is. And there are a number of other constants like that, maybe 20 such constants that physicists take for granted. We're not going to try to explain any further than that. And up until 1970 or so, it was an article of faith. People thought, well, physics just happens to be what it is, and life is opportunistic. Whatever the laws of physics happen to be, life will find a way to create a self-reproducing machine using that physics. And once you have a self-reproducing machine, you have the start of a Darwinian process, and Darwin takes you from there to whatever level of complexity we now observe. That certainly was, in my youth, the way people thought about physics. And then there was a a conference paper by Brandon Carter that talked about these anthropic coincidences, and it didn't receive much attention until a really interesting combination, Carr and Rees. This is, come on, blanking on his first name, C-A-R-R and Rees was at the time one of the most prominent astrophysicists in the world, and Carr was his graduate student, but also a mystic who went on to a dual career in the, certainly as a distinguished scholar in astrophysics, but also as a psychic, an advocate for psychic research, and president of the British Psychic Society for a while. So these two guys together put the subject on the map with a paper they wrote in 1979, listing some of these coincidences. You ask, well, so if you assume that these constants of nature are arbitrary, you could imagine what would the universe be like if they were a little bit different, if the speed of light were a little different from what it is, or if the mass of an electron were a little different from what it is, or if the strong force, the force that holds nuclei together, or the electric force were a little bit different from what they are. Physicists had assumed that that was just an arbitrary, that each of those was just an arbitrary number. And yet, when Carr and Rees explored the consequences, they saw that the universe would just be very, very different if some of these parameters were changed by a quite small amount. And they ended up with the idea that we live in an incredibly small sweet spot among all the combinations of these parameters that there could possibly be. Most of them, the vast majority of them, lead to universes that are very dull. For example, there's only one element, hydrogen. It's hard to imagine how you would have living things in a world where there's only one element. Or you have a lot of elements, but gravity isn't strong enough to create stars and galaxies. So matter just stays spread out through space. And again, life becomes very improbable. It's a very dull universe. Or in others, the Big Bang gets its start, but then it collapses back on itself so fast that nothing really has a chance to happen. It collapses on itself maybe in 1,000 years instead of billions of years that the universe has been around now, which it seems life on Earth has been evolving for billions of years. And we have a sample of one. We imagine that that's how long it takes life to go from the first primitive forms to humans. So after that, scientists had to face this very uncomfortable fact that these fundamental constants seem to be fine-tuned in a way to make our universe an interesting place and a place that's hospitable for life. And most of these guys are confirmed atheists. They don't want to think in terms of intelligence or intention built into the universe at any level. And here's how they get around that. They say, well, maybe there are all possible universes, all possible combinations of these different constants. And we know there are a whole lot of them, but they're all those universes exist, but there's nobody to look at them because they are so dull. They never evolve life. And of course, it's no accident that we live in the universe that we happen to be living in. So I would say that most physicists today explain these anthropic coincidences. That's perhaps a bad name for it, but these coincidences in the physical constants that lead to the possibility of life. They explain it by saying, well, all possible universes exist. It's a vast, vast number of universes, but we don't need to explain why we live in this particular one. All of those other universes have nobody in them to look at them. So that is the explanation that doesn't invoke any kind of consciousness or universal, it doesn't invoke anything that smacks of religion.
It sounds kind of tautological, though, doesn't it?
Well, I would say it's a gross violation of Occam's razor. Occam's razor is you take the simplest possible explanation, and an explanation that requires billions and gazillions of extra universes really has a lot of baggage to carry in that theory, especially when you say that these universes are, there's no evidence for them, and there's no way that they can ever possibly be detected. They're just different universes from our universe.
So it's an article of faith. So to be anti-religious in this matter, you have to really have a lot of faith.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's bad science to assume all these extra universes. So what do you think if the if you don't accept that? Well, there's Stephen Barr, who thinks that this is evidence for a personal God, a God who created the universe. And, of course, God created the universe to be a home for man. And man was created in his image. And he readily, freely talks about relationships to the Bible. Not a literal interpretation of the Bible where God created the world in 7 days. He's very much a believer in the Big Bang. But a general interpretation where there's an omnipotent being who set the world into motion and created the physical laws as they are. And I'm not a Catholic. I'm more of a Taoist. I see the universe as imbued with intelligence, that perhaps consciousness is primary, and consciousness had a role in creating matter. I think of a great consciousness that subsumes all of our little consciousnesses, rather than us thinking of an omnipotent being. Or maybe consciousness is a property of matter. Rather than consciousness creating matter, maybe matter and consciousness are intimately entwined from the very beginning. So there's a way to think about this that has, maybe it's the spiritual but not religious view of the world, which is closer to where I am.
Interesting. Actually, parts of that sound close to what I would identify as a kind of classical, a certain kind of monotheistic religious position. That is the consciousness. Basically, my understanding of Islamic cosmology would be that there's sort of a primordial absolute unity of consciousness that then, this is Neoplatonic, I suppose, as well. It's pretty similar, somehow there's a creation from absolute singularity to multiplicity, and that, you know, what we experience is space, time, and matter, and all of that is way down the hierarchy into, you know, extreme multiplicity. And so that's not that different from what your hypothesis of a primordial consciousness that's essentially dreaming up reality. The consciousness is the basis of everything. And also in, you know, Islamic thought, rather than existence, the way it's expressed in European languages, it's translated as wujud, which just means finding. So existence is what is found. So the consciousness of the finder is actually kind of the primordial thing, and what's found is just in relation to that. There's no sort of independent existence of it as existence per se. Either way, I mean, I think that if you're a theist, you're going to probably say that consciousness is primordial and that space, time, and matter are epiphenomena of consciousness and that God is just the ultimate consciousness.
I want to mention two people who our listeners might want to consult if they're interested in this. One is Amit Goswami, who's also a very competent physicist, but a mystic as well. And he's done a lot to try to combine these views together. And he says consciousness is the ground on which all reality is constructed. The other is Bernardo Kastrup, K-A-S-T-R-U-P, who is a very articulate spokesman for the radical view that consciousness is all that exists in the world. It's sort of the mirror image of these guys who say physical reality is the only reality and consciousness is an illusion. Kastrup says consciousness is the only reality and matter is an illusion concocted by consciousness. I can't do it justice.
No, it's great stuff. I read one of his books.
Yeah.
I was quite impressed. That's some pretty serious classical idealism.
Yes. He's a deep thinker.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good stuff. You actually sent out something about a scientist I hadn't heard of before, Monica Gagliano, who studies consciousness of plants. And she did a talk on imagination in science. It's only about, 20 minutes long, but that's the most mind-blowing 20-minute science talk I ever saw. And I think that's relevant to this, right?
What a wonderful scientist is Monica Gagliano. And on my webpage that I referred you to, I wrote a poem in tribute to her just a few days ago. So Monica Gagliano, I'll just give you briefly her story. She started out life as a scientist studying the social ecology of fish. And that involved getting to know the fish. And she had this wonderful life underwater where she I'm starting to think
this is
story
Jane
is too long.
Hanging out with chimps.
It's too good.
She's
a story.
She's the Jane Goodall of fish.
I'm going to tell the story even if it takes a little time. So she's hanging out with these fish every day, and they get to know her, and she's feeling close to these fish. And that comes to the end of the experiment where her job is to take the fish in the net back to the lab, cut them open, and study their brains. And instead of going out there and finding all the fish swimming with her and accepting her, she goes out that day and there isn't a fish in sight. All these fish that she'd come to know as individuals, somehow they knew that this was the day that she was not their friend. And this, when that happened, it just created a great shift in her consciousness and said, she said, I can't do this anymore. I'm not cutting up any fish. That's not going to be my career. And she switched to behavioral ecology of plants. What? There is no behavioral ecology of plants. Plants don't sense their environment. They don't talk to each other. There is no behavioral ecology of plants. And she set out to, just inspired by the idea that maybe these things exist. She has done remarkable, simple, but elegant and very rigorous experiments to show, for example, that plants have memories, to show that plants respond and can learn from their past experience and respond differently because of their past experience. Now, we think we understand learning in animals as a function of the synapses in our brains. The standard model is that when you do something enough times, then that synapse becomes stronger and stronger each time that you do it, and you come to learn a certain response because you've done it over and over. Well, plants don't have synapses. They don't have nerves. They don't have brains. There's nothing in the plant that could even sense the environment as far as we know. And part of her experiments are sensory. We know that plants can sense light. It's clear that plants must have active sensory organs to sense light. But she's shown that they also sense motion. They sense light breezes, just a little bit of wind. They sense sound. She's put plants in environments where there's water flowing, but separated so that the water never touches the plant. And the plant hears the sound and grows its roots in the direction where it hears the sound. These are just stunning experiments, and they make us rethink what a plant is, whether a plant can have sensations or even consciousness. And certainly we have to rethink neuroscience as the basis of being a sensory being. Some of what we regard as the grounds for showing that we are sensitive beings that are aware of our environment, plants can do that too, and yet they don't have ears or eyes or sense organs or even nerves or brains. We have no idea how the plants do that. And that's an active area now of Monica's research. She's in Western Australia, although she wrote a book a couple of years ago, and since then she's quite an internet presence. She's a sought after speaker and just very inspiring. I mean, she talks about experiences in the Amazon where she goes on these vision quests, ayahuasca trips with a shaman, and the plants talk to her and give her the design for the experiment, which, you know, it sounds really woo-woo until she goes home and puts her scientist hat on.
They're like experimenting on her.
Yeah, you bet. So she's getting information on the plants, how to do these experiments, and she goes home and puts her scientist hat on, and she turns them into just bulletproof methodologies for demonstrating that that plants have these learning capabilities and sensing capabilities. So I highly recommend Monica Galliano.
Yeah, well, the video that you sent me gives a really good argument for why we should be thinking of plants in the Bernardo Castro sense as consciousness, right? Because she's saying that they not only, you know, can sense and respond, but they also have imagination. That is, if she ran the Pavlov's dog experiment on a plant, feeding it instead of dog food, feeding it light, and then matching the light she was going to feed it with a little breeze so that the plant would respond to the breeze and turn, you know, go phototropic towards the light, just like the dogs would salivate in Pavlov's experiment. And
yeah, in an analogy to the Pavlov experiment, where the dogs learned to associate a bell, which is an arbitrary thing, with food, which is something that makes them salivate, she used a breeze to tell the plants what direction the light would be coming from the next day. And she taught the plants to grow toward the breeze or away from the breeze. I mean, she's done it in both directions. So to prove that the plants are really learning, the plants can learn to grow toward the breeze or away from the breeze if she trains them to know that that's the direction that the light is going to be coming from the next day.
Mm-hmm. And then she explains that the way to think about this is not in the kind of classic Pavlovian materialistic sense that you're just conditioning a dog to drool or you're conditioning a plant to grow towards this or that direction, but rather to know that the dog is conscious, that there's a consciousness that likes food. You know, a dog has its volition, has its consciousness, and learns with its imagination to associate the bell with the food. Likewise, the plant has an imagination, and it is associating its food, which is light, with the breeze. So there's a consciousness there which is primordial, and what's going on in material reality is just an expression of that. And so I think that's very, you know, it's a kind of a tangible acting out or a manifestation of what Kastrup is saying about all of existence.
Maybe she's right. I don't know whether plants actually have consciousness. Certainly she's moved us in that direction. A lot of my research is in the direction of showing that whole ecosystems are evolved to work together. And that gives us a sense that life is interdependent, and it makes me friendly to the idea that plants need to be respected as well as animals, and that the idea of monoculture farming, I guess it's got to be on its way out as we see that the farms are failing more and more, needing more and more pesticides and more fertilizer to keep going. We need to be living in natural ecosystems the way the Native Americans were living in natural ecosystems. There's one more topic that I wanted to squeeze
but we only
in
have one more minute.
The hour.
One more minute.
Oh, one more minute. Oh, gee. Well, the one more minute, I want to refer people to the experiments of Robert John, J-A-H-N, and Brenda Dunn at Princeton in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and up into 2000-something, when they demonstrated that human intention can have an effect on what quantum mechanics regards as random. And I think this just changes the whole picture. It blows the materialist view of the world out of the water. You have to recognize that mind has a separate existence of its own. Once you see those experiments, and once you take them seriously, realizing that mind, even in these very arbitrary experiments, mind can affect the random number generators, the quantum random number generators.
Mind can't stop time as much as we wish it could.
All right, so I'll just
play. Thank you so much.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern.